Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. I'm getting into middle age, and I've noticed that when I hear mention of someone I haven't seen in a while, I can quickly recall that person's face, but not always their name. Why do faces come back to me more quickly than names? I'm going to put that question to a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University, Dr. Scott A. Small. He's also the director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and he's the author of a book called Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering. And we're going to talk to him about why the director of an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center would want to talk about the benefits of forgetting. Welcome, Dr. Small.
Thank you. That was a perfect introduction.
So my question, why are faces coming back to me more quickly than names these days?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. In general, it has to do really with part of it has to do with the fact that faces are really more distinct, more unique than names. And it turns out that our brains are really more hardwired to recognize faces. And that's part of it. The other part is really the difficulty you're expressing, if it's really worsening over time, that really reflects some age-related changes in the way our mind is able to bind two kinds of information, in this case, visual information with auditory information, names.
So you're telling me that these are maybe stored in two different places and they have to be connected?
That's exactly right. And that's basically, you know, there are many ways to define memory, but one of the definitions of memory is the binding of pieces of information. And that, of course, happens in a complicated way across many areas of the brain. But fundamentally, you can describe it exactly as you did. There are two modules in the brain, one for faces, one for names. And what our memory ability reflects is our ability to bind those two.
Mm. And we are going to talk about the benefits of forgetting. But I'm sure in your line of work you get all the time, are you going to be able to cure forgetting, you know, as whether it's age-related or disease-related in the case of Alzheimer's?
Yes. Well, this is a good opportunity, if you don't mind, for me to emphasize that in a somewhat formal sense, we distinguish, and I do so in the book, between what is considered pathological forgetting, the forgetting that happens with the normal wear and tear of aging, and of course in disorders like Alzheimer's, versus the normal forgetting, the forgetting that we're born with, that occurs naturally, that we all experience. And I think what you're asking, maybe at this point, is are there any ways to intervene when a patient presents to me with pathological forgetting?
Mm-hmm.
The simple answer is not yet, but I am not by nature an optimist, but I think there's reasons to be cautiously optimistic that in the near future we will.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep that in mind, but I really want to talk about this really interesting premise of the benefits of forgetting. And to do that, though, I'd like to talk about some disorders because I think they really highlight how the brain works. So let's start with autism. I understand that people with autism excel at storing certain types of memory.
Right. And I hope you don't mind, but as a clinician, as a compassionate clinician, I have to quickly emphasize that when one talks about autism, one has to be careful about simplifying it. And you know that there are many people who think autism is not a disorder, it's part of diversity, autism is not singular. But as a general point, you're absolutely right. People with autism seem to have occasionally really remarkable memories, but it's for a specific kind of memory. It's something we call rote memory. So, you know, the proverbial laundry list, the ability to remember dates or songs off the top of their heads. That's very different than I think most of us consider the kind of synthetic memory we all like. You just described associating a face with a name. That's very different than the sort of rote memory. That's synthetic memory.
And how does Savant syndrome illustrate this really powerfully?
Right. So savant, again, a term I sort of dislike because it has sometimes a pejorative connotation, but what it really means formally is that, you know, I can evaluate your cognitive abilities, your memory, your language, your calculation abilities, and usually all of our abilities are roughly the same. Someone who has savantism, they have a peak of a particular cognitive ability that's towering above their other abilities. And in the context of this book, that peak is reflected in this really remarkable rote memory.
And so if that's an advantage that people with autism have, is that they can really hang on to these facts. Where's the struggle then? How do you explain the struggle?
Yeah, the struggle is so interesting. The struggle is that it turns out, and this comes out of the what I call the new biology of forgetting, by which I mean the biology and the insights that have emerged in the last 10 years, that have identified a separate group of sort of nanomachines in our brains that are dedicated explicitly to forgetting, not memory. We have a separate one dedicated to memory. And some of those nanomachines seem to be altered in people with autism, some people, and that might explain why they're forgetting for certain things is actually not as well balancing memory as it should be. So rote memory is maybe the benefit of that, but what emerges from the science of forgetting is that that comes at a price, because in order to have really good rote memory, it really requires you to not necessarily see the forest from the trees. You're sort of obsessed with the forest. You can't extract generalizations and what's sometimes called gists, and that's the trade-off there.
You don't get the gist, and okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, what about people? Is it true that some people have a photographic memory?
Yeah, so technically we have to define that. So when people talk about photographic memory, the formal term, which is useless, we in medicine like to come up with Latin terms, eidetic memory. it's a somewhat of a myth. It's a myth only because sometimes people think when they hear photographic memory that that person could, like our iPhone or our phone cameras, take snapshots of everything, and everything is stored forever. People with really exceptional photographic memory, more colloquially, they have remarkable memories for certain aspects of their lives. So the famous one is autobiographical memory. But that's just confined to their information of their personal history. If I were to test them in our memory labs, they actually wouldn't do exceptionally well on, you know, list learning tasks or remembering faces necessarily. So what turns out to be true is that some people have these remarkable memories for particular kinds of memories, but they're not the kind of all-encompassing retinal display photographic memories that we sometimes think.
And this is what's really interesting, because I think this is starting to get at the crux of your book. Would you want a photographic memory?
Right. And I start the book by saying, if you were to ask most people, including myself until a few years ago, the answer would be yes. I've dedicated my career to fighting forgetting tooth and nail, to considering more memory always a noble goal. And that's understandable. I'm now talking about normal forgetting, the one that balances our normal memory, because after all, we live in an information-rich environment. We all want to be that person who can quote Shakespeare or list statistics in a political debate. It turns out that that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if someone has no forgetting in the extreme, it turns out that they would live miserably lonely, uncreative, and unfulfilling lives.
All right. And we're going to get into why that is the case. I think one of the most interesting examples or explanations in the book is from your own personal history. Scott Small, in your book, Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering, you discuss PTSD, and you, I think if I'm getting this straight, you argue that it may be caused by not having the opportunity to forget. So I'm wondering if you would just sketch for us your experience serving in the Israeli army in the battle for Beaufort Castle.
Yeah, Beaufort Castle, many, many decades ago, but it's still in my memory. And the question is, why has it not seared my emotional memory such that I suffer from PTSD? So
right.
If I may, quick background there. So the structure of the book is to really try to make this accessible by talking about patients or leading scientists in the world that cover each topic. And as we were thinking of PTSD, the question was posed to me by the PTSD expert at Columbia, well, why don't you talk about yourself, because he knew that I served in this unit and I had that experience. And I said, of course not. This is not that, this is not a memoir. But I was convinced to do it. And so at many levels, it's the easiest chapter to understand, because I think most people understand intuitively that in terms of emotional memories, fear memories, it's not a bad thing to let go. Letting go is just a colloquial term for forgetting. You need to forget to forgive, right? And in fact, PTSD is a typical disorder of where you have too many fear memories in your mind that are really just too hot for your mind to handle, and it really has negative consequences. So that's a little bit of the background.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned from talking to the PTSD expert is that what you really want to try to do, well, you can almost ask a sort of clinical question. You have two people, both exposed to the same emotional trauma. One person develops PTSD, a brain on fire with too many memories, emotional memories, and another person who somehow learns how to douse those memories. Again, a colloquialism for forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are the risk factors? What factors into that? And there's a lot of things, of course. One can't simplify this. But the interesting thing I learned from him is that socializing, living a life surrounded by friends, family, love, and laughter is one of the strongest risk factors for preventing PTSD, or to state it differently, if you suffer that emotional trauma and then you're forced to be socially isolated, that's a significant risk for having PTSD.
And I want you to share your own experience, because it really does illustrate it. You had kind of this, I don't know, I was never in the Army, but it seemed really interesting and unique experience after you fought a really intense trench warfare battle. Then you were kind of just in a holding pattern with all of your comrades for several weeks.
We were in a special ops unit, what's called a commando unit, and we were sent in the night before of what's called the 1982 war, the first Lebanese war. We were tasked with securing this Crusader castle that was manned by the Syrian commando, and it overlooks Israel, and they were lobbing rockets into the kibbutzes in northern Israel, etc. So we were sent in to conquer that, and that turned out to be a very bloody battle. Because we were a special ops unit, most units, once you're in enemy territory, you stay there and you keep on going to whatever next project you need to do or task you're asked to perform. But because we were special ops, we were actually quickly sent back to our home base in northern Israel. And that's where I describe potentially, and with the help of the PTSD expert, explain that intense socialization that we all experienced, and we sort of carried on and we were sort of comrades in arms, that might have really helped why many of us did not suffer PTSD.
Because you had all this time, and I think you were kind of, there was some dark humor going on. You said you performed skits. And, I mean, maybe to act out and to kind of, I don't know, you're the brain scientist here, but are you remapping the memory when you can kind of address it satirically and maybe joke about it, or just even talking about it over and over
again? Yes. So, of course, now I'm using my brain understanding now to apply to my experiences then, which is an interesting experience. But basically what you're describing is true. It turns out that socializing and humor in particular, macabre or not, is a way to wash out the bloody hues of a memory. That is what the PTSD expert of the PTSD field has learned, that one way to blunt the shards of the memory, many metaphors, to bleach out the blood of the memory, is to really engage in humor and laughter. And we did it. We were kids. We were 19. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, in retrospect, we thought we were super cool. In retrospect, it seems very sophomoric what we were engaged in. But it, I think, therapeutically helped us.
So I guess there's actually a coda to that story, Dr. Small, because recently, so this is several decades after your Army service, you and a couple of your buddies from your unit got together, and one of them had kept this American flag that was part of your kind of dark humor and spoofing of what had happened. And they came to your apartment in Manhattan, and you unfurled it, and you expected some, like, big emotional moment, and then that's not what you got. But yet seeing that flag helped you heal even more.
It did help us, because now when we get together and we're the close friends who were in this battle and everything, and we're thankfully friends still, we now spoof it more. So back to the idea of humor being a way to wash out the bloody memories. So it completely helped us therapeutically. But we all expected the opposite. We expected there to be drums and horns in the background as we unfurled the flag, and it was a big fizzle. If anyone has experienced that similar fizzle when they go to a class reunion, you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I guess I need to ask back up a little bit here, but are negative traumatic memories stickier than other memories in general?
Yes. So when it comes to emotional memories, right, there are many emotional memories, happy and sad ones, exuberantly celebratory ones, and fearful ones. It's the negative ones that stick. And I do use this great proverb, I think it's a French proverb, that says that happiness is written in white. It doesn't show up in the page. Mm. And that's why often melodramas go to the negative, not just the happy. So there's something about fear memories, emotional memories that are negatively charged, that we are inclined to remember much more than happy memories.
Okay, so if I have a situation where I have an emotional flashback to something very painful, could you describe that as a failure of forgetting?
Well, you know what? That's why it was really great that you started with the example of a face and a name. Because if you boil that down to a simple way of understanding how the brain memorizes things, two kinds of information. In that case, an auditory information coupled with visual information. But now you can also do the same thing and say, well, let's say visual information with emotional information, because emotions are actually types of information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a flashback of something traumatic that had to happen to you, you can remember the details, the person, perhaps if it was a bully. But if it's not tightly associated with the emotional valence of that memory, with the emotional charge of that memory, that flashback will stop in the way it should be, in just a recollection. If it's bound too tightly, too much memory, too little forgetting, then that recollection, maybe seeing that person even today, will trigger a detrimental emotional response. So that's the way brain scientists kind of think of that.
And so for people who maybe are already suffering from PTSD and didn't have the opportunity that you did to decompress, if that's what it is that, you know, prevented you from getting PTSD, what can they do at this point in their lives to maybe unbind the emotion from, you
right.
know, the face or the name or whatever?
Well, it's interesting. So first of all, it raises relevant current information. If we consider for some people COVID being a trauma, and for many people it is an emotional trauma, the double whammy there is that not only are you suffering that trauma, and I hear that from some of my patients, in fact, but they're forced to live in isolation. That's
mm-hmm.
already a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what was interesting to me, if I could quickly editorialize, that I'm a doctor who thinks on, you know, drugs and how to cure Alzheimer's, but here's a behavioral intervention that is advocated by the field in PTSD. You know, soldiers coming back from combat, make sure that they're surrounded with a social fabric. That is factually true. There are ways in which drugs work, and they, by the way, work by inducing forgetting to loosen that connection between factual information and emotional memories.
Well, what about talk therapy? I mean, you've mentioned some drugs, and I'm sure that people pursue that in their treatment. But is there a benefit to just talking? Is that maybe part of the problem we're all up against right now when we've been in isolation, is that we don't have enough people to bounce this off of and joke around with about how horrible this is?
I think that's absolutely a conclusion that I arrived at in talking to the PTSD experts. And I talk about talk therapy, and I use the talk generally. Conversation among friends is what you're alluding to, and which is what the greatest worry when grandparents can't see their grandkids. But talk therapy could also be with a capital T, you know, formal psychotherapy. And in many ways, although I have a feeling my colleagues in the psychotherapy world might feel this too reductionist, too simplified, but in many ways what talk therapy does do is try to disentangle the binding of emotional memories with factual information. Certainly exposure therapy does that. So in many ways...
What's the difference between talk therapy and exposure therapy?
I'll give you my definition. Talk therapy, I usually mean talking with a therapist and really talking about personal stuff. And that could be cognitive behavioral therapy or psychodynamic therapy. Exposure therapy is really more of a prescription where, as I think you know, if you have a phobia for a snake, let's say, in exposure therapy, what they do is they repeatedly show you the provocative stimulant repeatedly over time, but in a benign setting. And if you think about that, that is effectively engaging our forgetting mechanisms. So that's the distinction I'm making. I'm not sure if it's universally held as true.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Small. He's the author of Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering. In just a moment, we'll find out how forgetting enhances creativity. That's coming right up on Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor. We're speaking with Dr. Scott Small. He's the author of Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering. Now, you quote the scientist Francis Crick. He says, we dream in order to forget. Will you explain the importance of sleep?
Yes. I learned a lot in reading and studying for writing these chapters, and that really turned out to be really interesting. Because if you think about it, we all sleep. And by the way, when I say all, down to flies, mice, all animals sleep. We all spend at least a third of our lives in somber, in a position that's potentially vulnerable. So why are we sleeping? And it's one of the great mysteries. Francis Crick, 40 years ago, who, as you point out, was one of the Nobel winners for decoding the structure of DNA, after he solved that simple problem, he said, okay, what else is out there? He said, sleep and consciousness. He was a very ambitious man, but he should have been because he was brilliant. And one of his insights about sleep is that we need to sleep in order to forget. Now, he proposes in a formal paper, I think it was 1983, and, you know, it created a big splash, but it was hard to really formally test that. Only in the last few years have scientists, many of them who are students of his, been able to use new technologies that can actually formally test that and show that he was right. One of the reasons we sleep is in order to trim our memories. Trimming is another colloquialism for forgetting.
So if people are sleep deprived, how dangerous is that?
Super dangerous. And since you were kind enough to ask me about my military experience, I was forced to be sleep deprived for 3 days. There were many ways in which we were tortured as trainees in this unit. And it is, I was formerly psychotic. I mean, you see things, you can't think straight. That is the best example of a brain on fire with too many memories. That's a great example of how you need to sleep in order to forget, in order to sort of clean your mind of extraneous information to prevent your mind to become staticky with extraneous information. That's a really important part of sleep. And I'm sure many people, I hope few people were forced to be sleep deprived for 3 days, but most people by necessity in our busy worlds have been sleep deprived at least for a night. If you've experienced that staticiness of your mind, you've experienced a brain without forgetting.
So creativity, it seems to me that creativity is about making new connections and presenting new information in new ways. So why is forgetting important for creativity?
Yeah, this is all part of the same chapter and where I had discussions in that case with Jasper Johns, one of the leading artists. It was really fascinating to talk to him about creativity. There has been a science on creativity, and of course, creativity is one of these complicated things, but the general conclusion is that creativity, that eureka moment where you have that sort of alchemy in your brain, where you suddenly go, aha, that aha moment, requires two things. It requires you to immerse yourself with a lot of information. So we just talked about how the brain has different ways of processing information, maybe words for poets, visual information for artists, but even factual information for creative scientists. So you need to be immersed with that information, but it's critically important that the associations among those elements are not concretized, are not stapled with steel, because what the science of creativity has established, that you need to keep those associations loose and playful, because the eureka moment is when you say, wait a minute, that one piece of information is not necessarily linked to one thing, it's actually linked to something completely different. That is one way to define creativity. And in order for our brains to do that, we need forgetting to keep, to prevent our memory associations from being too fixed.
Now, I want to end, Dr. Small, with, I was surprised to find in your book such lengthy discussion of forgiveness. That came as a surprise to me, and I think it's really timely. You refer to the pandemic. We've actually become so divided during this pandemic, and we've been locked down and less likely to see in-person people who think differently than we do. And so I'm wondering if you can just draw on your thoughts about forgiving and also your work as a neurologist and just talk to us about how we can use our brain's power of forgetting to maybe heal some of the rifts in our nation and in our neighborhoods. I'm assuming if you think that's something that needs to happen.
I think it is, and I'm really thankful for you to bring that out, because I didn't explicitly say that, but it's implied in a number of chapters in the book. So a few things, if I may. Stop me if I'm a little off target here, but there's one chapter that compares chimps to bonobos, right? Chimps are meant to be xenophobic. They're very aggressive. They care about their clan. They will ruthlessly go after anyone out of their clan. Bonobos, who are complete cousins of theirs evolutionarily, actually they're both cousins of ours evolutionarily, they're the diametric opposite. And so to use simple terms, the chimp, although not the chimp, but the chimp typifies antisocial behavior. I'm not criticizing the chimp because that's evolutionarily right. I'm criticizing us, who tend to sometimes behave too chimp-like than we should. The bonobos are pro-social. They engage in friendship, in compassion, in lovemaking. And so you have these two evolutionary distinct cousins, chimps and bonobos, that are so close in their biology and their genes, yet they're diametric opposite in their personalities. And so I think, and you know, I worry, just like you, I grew up in Israel. I've seen what happens when there's sectarian violence, when people entrench too much in their position, when they become chimp-like. And I do talk about how one of the great distinctions between chimps and bonobos, if we learn from Mother Nature, is that chimps really can't emotionally forget. They take things too seriously. There's nothing wrong about liking your clan, your family, your nation. I also talk about the nationalism a bit. But it's a problem when your love of your clan, friends, and nation is burned so hot that it forces you to be a xenophobe. And that can occur in many social settings. And you're absolutely right. I see that very sadly now in our country. I'm not sure how to fix that. But maybe a sociologist can use this insight of new forgetting to translate that. The one thing I can say, though, if you think about it, right, is socializing. I'm not a sociologist, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but if I understand my sociology correctly, one of the ways in which racism was blurred a little bit in the 1950s is because we were all forced to serve in the same military. And I do think that working together, socializing together, is a great way to prevent your chimp-like antisocial behavior from burning too hot in your brain.
We've been speaking with Dr. Scott A. Small about his book, Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering. Thank you for giving us so much to think about.
Thank you for your interest in the book.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Up next, we'll speak with a person who lives with Highly Superior Autobiographical Memory, or HSAM. That means they practically remember everything. You may think it sounds fun. It's not fun. But it is fascinating. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. You may know someone who remembers everything, but there are only about 60 known people in the world who actually remember every day of their lives, down to the weather. What's it like to live an unforgettable life? To find out, Marcus Smith spoke with Rebecca Sherrick. In this highlight from that conversation, Marcus tested her skill by asking her about a specific date in 2006.
September the 27th, 2006, was a Wednesday. And on that particular day, there was still, in Australia especially, there was a lot of news about Steve Irwin's death, which I found out he passed away on September the 4th, which was a Monday. But on Wednesday the 27th, I didn't hear any new news that day, but I was still here. Whenever I'd watch the news, it was all about Steve Irwin and that.
Is this the kind of thing that you would ever write it down, or you're marking a calendar, you're observing the calendar as it goes by? Is it just a mental memory?
It's just, I remember how I just experienced my life that day. And autobiographical memories, it's a good description for them because they're the sort of memories you remember them as if they're written in an autobiography of your life.
So is it the event that you remember, the feeling of those experiences, your observations and thoughts that day, all of the above?
All of the above, but mainly the observation of the experiences, my feelings, my emotions, and just how I personally experienced the events of my past.
So you mentioned just a moment ago that we would have to start in 2004. Why was 2004 so important that you started associating specific calendar dates with memories?
2004, that was the first year when I had a calendar in my bedroom. So every morning when I get up, I cross the days off. But the memories before then, see, I was 14 in 2004, but the memories before then, I'd be able to give the date if I went to school that day and wrote down the date at the top of my piece of paper, or if it was Christmas or my birthday, I'd be able to say what day of the week it was on and such.
So you still have fairly crisp and clear memories of events before you had a calendar in your room.
Yeah.
But you just can't associate them with a date.
Yeah. Like I have the memories there, but I'd be more likely to date them if they were 2004 or onwards. But I do have, all my memories are in chronological order, so they start at the beginning of my life and then just go forth and forward to the present day. But I'd be able to tell what calendar date they fell on more easily if it was 2004 onwards. Or before then, I could remember an experience and then see a photograph of the experience I remember and it's dated.
So suppose I were to go to the year 1999, and if something happened in that year, you could remember it, and you wouldn't remember specific dates, but you would remember in relation to that event what happened before and what happened after in sequence.
All the memories from 1999, it would just take so long to explain every single one of them now because most of them are just classroom of me having my lunch at school during recess break. But 1999 was a very special year for me because during recess break, my teacher got me to read the Harry Potter books. And I'd never heard of the Harry Potter books before then, and I was skeptical as to whether I'd like them or not. But my teacher said, you've got to read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So I was reading that and I didn't think I'd like it, but then I surprised myself and I did like it. And since then, the Harry Potter books have become a really special part of my life now.
To call them a special part of your life is an understatement, I think.
Yeah, it's the strongest word I could have selected as to what those books mean to me.
Sure.
Just emotionally and...
Well, just to fill in anybody listening to you today, you actually can recite from memory all seven books?
Yeah. With reciting the books, I did that because due to reliving all the memories, and it would keep me awake at night to distract myself. I had to either listen to music, or then I found out I could get to sleep if I'd recite the books to myself, and it would distract my mind from flashbacks. So I learned to recite all 7 of them.
Do you still find that helpful today if you need distraction, that you're able to dive into the story and follow it through and recite it to yourself?
Absolutely, especially because if I'm away on, say, a mentoring camp, or if I'm away somewhere where I can't have music on, I can just recite the book silently to myself, and then it enables me to get to sleep in a less distracting way for other people.
Do you see this capacity of yours, HSAM, do you see this as something that you're grateful for?
I've never lived life any other way, so to me it's just the way life is, the way I accept it. But it has its ups and downs. The downs are definitely when I relive negative memories involuntarily, and I like to call them intrusive memories, because I could be having an experience which I'm supposed to enjoy, and then uninvitedly a negative memory just comes through and I relive the emotions and all that. See, that's a negative part. And another negative aspect of it is that all those memories in my head can be distracting when I just keep reliving everything. But the positives are I also relive happy memories and I relive happy emotions. So I can relive childhood birthdays and feel excited again, and I can relive my favorite vacations and just feel all the happiness and excitement again. So that's definitely the best part about having HSAM.
Now, when you say relive, can you describe for us the exact condition of this reliving? What are you seeing it? Are you hearing it? Are you remembering all the sensory experiences? If it was a happy day, what is this reliving?
The things I relive emotions. So all the emotions come back of that experience, all of the thoughts I had at that time. See, my conscience and reasoning remains in the present, but my emotions and my thoughts in relation to those emotions will be like they were at that past time. And it could be from when I was a lot younger as well. So if I'm reliving a memory from when I was 7, say, I'd experience confusion because I'd be feeling in a way a 7-year-old would feel about that past experience. And I also relive the scents as well, such as smells, tastes, and I can retaste my favourite food as well when I think about it. If I'm eating something bland and boring, such as potatoes, I can just think to myself, Black Forest Gatto, and I can taste that in my mouth.
Do you see?
So I like that.
Yeah, who wouldn't? If you given the choice between potatoes and the cake.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, tell me, I'm wondering if you see your approach to having HSAM and living from day to day, do you see you managing and coping and controlling it at some level?
In the past few years, I've been doing therapy to help me control these feelings and emotions. So since 2015, I've been seeing a psychologist who specializes in autism, but she also specializes in post-traumatic stress disorder as well. See, with HSAM, because it's so unusual and so unique, and it was only discovered just a little over a decade ago, because it's so unusual that there aren't any exercises and therapies designed specifically for it. But we've found through research, because I'm involved in two research studies, one with the University of California and one with the University of Queensland, who are studying me, and in the case of the California University, 59 other people as well. But it's been found that exercises which are designed for post-traumatic stress disorder are really helpful for the vast majority of people with HSAN. So my psychologist gives me grounding exercises to do, and she teaches me mindfulness designed for PTSD, and it really helps me control, just to take it. Still happens. I still relive experiences inevitably, but it just helps me manage and control them whenever my mind just gets overwhelmed. And that's really helping me. And in the past couple of years, I've found that my anxiety has significantly reduced. It's still there, but it's reduced significantly.
Some people with HSAM have this condition come into their lives when they're 10 years old, when they're 15, when they're 20. You have it from a very early age. I understand back to events you remember when you were an infant.
Yeah, and when I tell people I can remember, and I just give memories of infancy, I get the two reactions I mainly get. Sometimes people go, no, you can't remember back to when you're an infant. That's impossible. And the other reaction I get most frequently is, wow, that's just so different, so incredible. But remembering back to when I was an infant just seems normal to me because I've always been able to do so. And the thought of living any stage of my life and just forgetting it, but living it, but just not having the memories there, that's just such a strange concept to me.
Rebecca Sherrick is a British autism advocate who lives with HSAM, which means she doesn't forget anything. She was speaking there with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're going to finish off the hour now with some happy memories from BYU Radio's resident storyteller, Sam Payne. Now, he may not remember everything, but he remembers the good stuff. Marcus Smith sat down to talk to him about skateboards.
It's a great pleasure to have Sam Payne come back and be with us again. Sam, of course, host of the BYU Radio storytelling show called The Appleseed, with storytellers from around the world. New episodes Monday through Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Sam Payne, you got any wheels with you? Because somebody told me you were going to be talking about wheels now.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. It's always so great to be on Constant Wonder. And I'll tell you what I'm thinking about. You know, sometimes I'll come and be a guest on your show. I'm very thankful for the invitation. And I'll bring something that I have written down. That's kind of, I do that a lot. I'll try to remember something story worthy about my life and write it down, and I'll come and bring to you something that I've written, and I'll read it to you.
Well, do you have like stacks and stacks of stories that you've written down over the years? Are they bound in any fashion?
Oh, no. But I will tell you, all of our lives are full of stacks and stacks of stories. And we do ourselves a favor when we do some writing down. But we don't always have that luxury, right? Sometimes we find ourselves called upon to tell a story from our life, and we don't happen to have one written down in our pocket, right? And we sometimes wonder how to organize our life for to facilitate the telling of stories. You know, I'm thinking of the Comedy of Errors by Shakespeare, right? With that opens with Aegeon, who's been captured and he's going to be put to death. But before they put him to death, they ask him to tell the story of how he has come to be put to death. And he looks out at the audience and he says, "Well, I was born." And everybody realizes that he's going to start a story there. Oh no, he's going to start the story where he was born, you know?
Nobody stands up and says, "Cut to the chase."
That's right. Yeah. Fortunately, he does kind of cut to the chase, right? But in terms of finding those cut to the chase moments, you know, we can we can, there are some useful organizing principles of storytelling, right? You could tell your story, your life story, in terms of the cars that you've owned, right? Or of girlfriends that you've had, right? And those become these kind of organizing principles that sort of help you get a handle on telling the story of your life. And oddly, I am not myself a skateboarder, but I have a bunch of skateboard stories. It's the weirdest thing in the world. I used to work with the teenage boys in my church congregation. And because I had an impact in his life, I guess, one of those boys one time came and gave me his second best skateboard.
Wait. Second best, you said.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, he was going to keep his best skateboard, right?
At least it wasn't third.
Yeah. And it was like autographed by some prominent skateboarders and things like that. Now, I all of that was lost on me, but the gift wasn't lost on me. I loved the gift, you know, I remember it a lot. And maybe that's the first important skateboard story in my life. Later on, I found myself playing with a band that played a gig in Tokyo. And it meant we were going to spend a week in Tokyo. And the drummer showed up in Tokyo with a skateboard in his backpack. He wanted to sort of see Tokyo by skateboard. And I said, wow, what an idea. I wish I'd have thought of something like that. And he said, oh, you don't have to worry about it. I thought about it for you. And he took out of his backpack a second skateboard that he had brought for me.
His second best, no doubt.
That's right. Yeah. So the drummer of the band and I saw Tokyo for 4 days or 5 days or however long we were there on skateboards.
Okay.
We
just
skateboarded the streets of Tokyo.
Yeah, it's kind of a crowded place, is it not?
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's incredible. We would get up early in the morning. We shared a hotel room and we would have a quick breakfast and then we would go out when the streets were relatively quiet and skateboard through the streets. Now, again, I'm no skateboarder. I can stand up on a skateboard without falling down if I'm not going very fast and if I'm going in a straight line, right? Ask any more of me and I don't got it. But it was such a memorable experience skateboarding through Tokyo with the drummer of this band, right? And fast forward a few more years and my wife and I are walking along a mountain path near our home that runs along a river. And there are a lot of skateboarders that frequent this path. It's a paved path and they drive their cars up to the top of the path and they get on these skateboards and they roll down, you know, 4 miles worth of path. And then they, I don't know, get somebody to come pick them up or something like that. But it's a long downhill longboarding experience, you know. And my wife and I were walking along and we saw there on the path quite a large spider, a spider impressive enough that it stopped us. And we looked at the spider and we got off the side of the path and we kind of enjoyed watching this spider kind of navigate its way across the path. When down the path comes this skateboarder. And he's going, I don't know, 30 miles an hour or something like that, you know. Anyway, 50 feet from him, he sees this spider. And he freaks out. He windmills his arms and he yells out as loud as I've heard anybody yell out. And he leaps off of his skateboard 10 feet in the air. And his skateboard goes careening off into the bushes. And he lands somewhere south of the spider, his legs just kind of going as fast as a person's legs could go before he could bring himself to a safe stop. It was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in the mountains, is this guy trying to avoid this spider by leaping off of his skateboard. Fast forward a couple of more years, and my wife and I are walking that same path when we see up ahead of us a college age girl, right? And she's coming toward us, and as we watch, she falls off of her skateboard. It's a horrible wreck, and we get up near where she is. We find that she has very, very obviously broken her leg. And so my wife and I have to carefully load her onto her skateboard and use the skateboard as a gurney to get her down to a parking lot where she could wait for the guy that she was with, who finally came back and found her, wondered where she was, and found her there with a broken leg, went and got the car, and brought it, and we all carefully loaded her into the car, and then away they went to the hospital, but not before we found out that they were on their first date. These skateboard stories, though I am, again, not myself a skateboarder. At a party, say, hey, anybody got any skateboard stories? I can say, I got about four of them. And there you go.
It reminds me of being on a road trip with some friends in college when all of a sudden a girl in the car says, well, you know how to say thank you in Tongan, don't you? And I said, no, I don't. And she says, how to say thank you in Tongan. And I say, well, you don't. You're not. How do you? And she says, oh, it's just all coming back to me. So if anybody asks you about your expertise on skateboards, just own it. And
that's
just,
right.
Just say, it's all coming back to me.
Hey,
okay?
You're talking to the expert here, and it's all coming back to me. So, but I guess the point is, you know, we sometimes find ourselves in a position where we're asked to say something about ourselves, and we don't really know how to tell our life story very well. And again, there are these kind of organizing principles that we can rely on. Have you owned some cars? Well, tell your story in the context of the cars that you've owned. Have you had some girlfriends? Well, tell that story. My dad likes to tell the story of his life in terms of the fretted instruments he has owned. You know, he's owned a lot of guitars in his life. And for me, today, with you, it's skateboards, Marcus.
You kind of find something, you weave in and out of that, and it guides you.
Yeah.
Maybe not in a straight line. Maybe there are bumps. Maybe there are spiders, but it guides you, and you know how to get there.
That's right. Every one of those skateboard stories opens a box of stories that's bigger than the skateboard story. I could say a lot more about Tokyo or about that drummer. I could say a lot more about that path and taking walks with my wife. I could say a lot more about working with those teenage boys in the church group. As long as I have a skateboard memory, I have a doorway through which I can go into a lot of those memories.
You're going to pick up skateboarding. You got it now. Okay. What is the closest thing to a skateboard that takes some balance and dexterity that you've mastered?
Well, mastered is a strong word, but I've always been pretty good on a pair of roller skates, if you want to know.
Let's go.
That's right.
Well, Sam, a delight to have you with us. Thanks for being with us again today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Marcus.
Sam Payne, the host of the BYU Radio storytelling show called The Appleseed. And once again, new episodes Monday through Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific.
Marcus Smith there. I'm Tenery Taylor. Wednesday on Constant Wonder, disco changed the dance scene forever.
But we took that song, Theme from Shaft, my DJ partner. And they had two copies of it, and they would continue that song for like 10 minutes by playing the bridge over and over. This was a new experience. It was euphoric.
The importance of disco clubs to a rising black middle class. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.